This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The Biden administration has spent much of its first month in office focusing on how to tame the pandemic. But much of the news is still pretty grim. The vaccine rollout continues to be chaotic, and it's plagued by inequities of all kinds. And no less important, new variants, mutations of the virus, are circulating in the world, and we have yet to get a handle on how to deal with them. Atul Gawande is a surgeon and a public health expert, and recently, he served on the COVID task force of the Biden transition team, which was disbanded just after the president was sworn in. He's been a staff writer for The New Yorker for many years. Atul, we had the first doses in the United States administered just over a couple of months ago. How is that rollout going?
The vaccine rollout, so, you know, at the very beginning, it seemed like we were all breakthrough and no follow through. We hit 1.7 million vaccines a day. Basically, the capacity to deliver vaccination has been rising steadily. And around the 26th, we'll have the presentation of the Johnson & Johnson data on their vaccine to the FDA, which could mean, I think it's likely we'll see an approval within a week after that and a whole new supply chain coming. So those, you know, where we are on vaccine delivery is in the top five in the world. So I consider us to be starting to turn the corner here.
I guess what's so disturbing to me and unnerving is the amount of resistance that we see to vaccines. We have some populations who are very suspicious of government, and for good reason historically. We have the anti-vaxxer movement, which has its doubts, whether either through conspiracy theory or doubts about the science. We have all kinds of populations and millions of people, if you add it up, who are resistant. Why isn't the government, Oprah Winfrey, whatever would be effective on television and radio and on the internet 24 hours a day, helping make this effort easier?
The vaccine definitely has had a level of anxiety, but the actual anti-vaccine attack has been relatively muted. As more vaccine rolls out, and we're past 40 million people vaccinated now, you are talking about, you know, a case where people all know somebody who's been vaccinated. They're seeing what the effects are. They've seen that we haven't seen suddenly, you know, unusual deaths or anything like that occurring. And so the vaccine confidence has risen enormously. We now have more than 70% of Americans reporting that if they had the chance to get the vaccine today, they would take it. That is higher than we've seen, and I think that will continue to rise. There are still a bunch of people who are fence sitters. Those are smaller in number, but that doesn't alarm me. I totally understand the impulse to say, I want to wait. I do think we have clear evidence that getting the vaccine is far better than getting the coronavirus.
That is for sure.
Yeah.
Now, Atul, you just published a piece about Minot, North Dakota, and the drama there and the politics of the public health measures, not just the vaccination itself. Why did you choose to concentrate on that town, and what did you find?
I got interested in Minot because North Dakota in the fall was the state with the worst outbreak. And Minot was in the county that was the worst hit in North Dakota. And I want to understand what is making it so difficult for us to come together and address the crisis. Because in North Dakota, they had not embraced having a statewide mask requirement. And in Minot, the city council took up the question, are we going to be willing to do something as their hospital was pleading for help? From being overrun. And, you know, it was raising this question, our democracy has frayed, and has it frayed so badly that it can't manage the crisis.
There was also a lack of ability to persuade, a lack of connection and integrity somehow between city council members, particularly city council members who wanted a mask law, and ordinary citizens who were in deep danger and seeing people all around them getting sick.
Well, I actually, so, you know, the interesting thing to me is I came away feeling like this was a success story. It wasn't pretty. There was deep divide. I showcased Kerry Evans, who introduced the proposal for the city to adopt a mask mandate, and Tom Ross on the other side, who was absolutely against adopting masks. And they were coming from two different worlds. But, you know, as I talked to Tom Ross and other opponents of the masks there, it wasn't that they were blind to how sick people were. They, you know, Tom Ross knew the first person who died in Minot. He became sick with the coronavirus himself. He was worried he would die. But they felt like the debate was all about deaths, deaths, deaths. What about all the damage of the response to the virus was their concern, whether it was kids who hadn't been in school for a year, the mental health damage, the rise in alcohol, domestic abuse, and what they felt like they saw as a destruction in their entire lives, making the connection that what we do now for the virus will help solve all of those problems. Tom Ross wasn't persuaded, and many of the opponents weren't persuaded, but the community was. And they not only passed the mask mandate, but by the end, 90% of people in North Dakota ended up adopting face masks. They restricted their movements. There was strong opposition. You won't get to consensus, but they were able to move forward and actually get the hospitalizations and the deaths down. They got it down, you know, 80%.
You recently wrote an op-ed that emphasized, whether it's Pfizer or AstraZeneca, that all vaccines prevent hospitalization and death due to COVID-19. But we're also being told at the same time, Atul, even once you've been vaccinated, you should still practice social distancing. So do you think public health officials have been making a mistake by downplaying the efficacy of the vaccine somehow?
Well, so it's worth pulling these two things apart. And it is hard to grasp that, on the one hand, these vaccines appear to be, evidence so far, you know, almost 100% protective against the worst outcomes of the of these infections, hospitalization and death. On the other hand, it is not at all clear that they stop you from being infected. And, you know, we don't know if it stops you from transmitting. We are seeing from some of the results in the UK signs that, you know, there is some transmission that likely does go on from people who get infected. And because of the development of mutations, that is a concern, that if we continue spreading such high levels, I mean, we have hundreds of thousands of people who are actively infected with the virus right now, we will need to get to the point where we've shut down that transmission as well.
A simple question. If you're fortunate enough to get vaccinated and soon, how does that do against the what we're hearing about new strains and mutations of the virus?
Well, so there's two different stories here, which only makes this story more complicated, right? So half of my answer to you about like why are public health people making this so complicated is that the damn science keeps being complicated. So the UK variant, the B117 variant, its doubling time is only 10 days. It's past 5% of all of the infections in Florida. And it is a variant that is 30 to 50% more contagious, which means 30 to 50% more hospitalizations, deaths just from that. Plus, it is more lethal. It is more likely to put you in the hospital. And that one is the one that alarms me a great deal. We have a very effective vaccines. Our vaccines work against this variant. Israel is predominantly infected by this variant, and they've had a 94% reduction in infections among people who got the vaccine. So what I think is the single most important thing is getting as many people over 65 or with two comorbidities vaccinated within the next 12 weeks. The second part is the South African variant and the Brazil variant are further mutations that add on to what UK mutation. And those show some signs of potentially evading the vaccine. Now, we have it popping up in small numbers in the United States. We don't know if it will spread as quickly as the UK variant will, but those are clearly going to need vaccine boosters, perhaps in the fall, perhaps in a year from now.
Now, guidelines are all over the place in the United States. You live in the Boston area, and in Massachusetts, they just announced a new, and I thought pretty surprising, vaccine guideline that anyone accompanying an adult over the age of 75 gets a vaccine too. Why'd they do that?
Well, so one of the interesting things that happened, and it's happening in many states, which is they opened up to everybody over 75, and a lot of 75-year-olds came in, but not everybody. For example, in Massachusetts, 200,000 of the 430,000 people over the age of 75 came in and got vaccinated, but that meant the majority did not. And I thought it was incredibly creative that here in my state, they said, hey, bring in one of those folks who are missing and you'll get vaccinated as well. You know, it led to crazy headlines about people offering to pay the elderly $200 and I'll give you a ride to get your vaccine. People are that desperate to get vaccinated themselves. And a lot of anger, you know, I'm going to see a 25-year-old jump the line or people who are connected and well-off jumping the line. But in some ways, what I really appreciate is the idea that the people with the connections will be reaching out and getting the people who don't have that ability to navigate the system and get them in. I'm part of running a bunch of vaccine centers, and it's worked. We are seeing a lot of folks come in that otherwise wouldn't have been able to come in or weren't coming in.
What do we still need to improve on in this process if we're going to get to anything like universal or at least near universal vaccination?
I think the areas of next opportunity are ones that continue to reduce the barriers. You know, one thing I've advocated for example, is we have a crazy billing system in the United States. It's $17 that Medicare will pay for a single vaccine. Setting up the billing systems has slowed down the vaccine operations. Sending out the bills, you know, can cost $5 to send a bill for a $17 vaccine. We're going to need to give this to every American. We should get money from the insurers. I would advocate saying, look, your insurers should pay for every member, but send that money to the government and let's just get rid of the billing part of this. That would simplify the software. We're seeing people being asked to give their insurance card, of course. And then you tell them, well, it's not going to cost you anything, but I want your insurance card. You know how many people don't trust that? All of that can go away. There are many aspects of trying to make the system streamlined that are going well. There's still more that can be knocked out, and I hope they'll continue to get at them.
Now, the last time we spoke, it was December, and you told me that you think we might return to normal sometime this summer. And given the new information about variants and vaccination and everything we've been talking about, where does your answer stand now?
So it has gotten more complicated. I didn't imagine we would have strains that would potentially evade the vaccines. And we also have the complexity that the trials for kids are not complete. The studies in kids age 12 and older are going to come out in late summer. And the trials in kids age 6 and up are only starting now. So that means a big part of the population will still potentially be affected by COVID. So, you know, where will we be? My suspicion is we're going to be in a world by end of summer where we don't have hospitalizations and don't have deaths in the kinds, anything like the numbers we've had. We will have it down below flu level numbers. Once we're below flu level numbers, the country is going to want to throw the mask away.
And that's a mistake.
Well, I think it's going to be a real debate because if our goal was get to zero, then we weren't going to, you know, that would be the moment when we say everybody get free. But when the goal is now that knowing we're not going to get to zero, it's that we need to be able to get back to our lives. And we're going to have a real debate, even among public health people, about where to draw that line. But I think by the fall, we're going to be, and summer, we're going to be in the thick of a debate about, well, if it's below where flu was, can we tolerate that? I compare it to when we decided we're going to move the speed limit back up from 55 miles an hour to 65 miles an hour, knowing that was going to be thousands of deaths a year, and it continues to be debated. But, you know, we decided this is where we drew the line, and it was a political decision as much as a public health one.
When you say it's going to take a while, at what point can I go to the movies, to Yankee Stadium, to take an airplane flight, not with a mask and not be thinking about this all the time?
So this is what makes it hard. I think the most likely thing is this gets beaten down to become an endemic chronic flu-like illness that circulates, that we will have developed some antiviral treatments as well. I think we will also have discovered that wearing the mask stops the flu, which it did this last year, and any remaining COVID in circulation. And we're going to have some changes in norms where there are people who decide, you know what, it's perfectly fine to wear the mask when I travel and I'm in places because I don't want to get a cold. I don't want to get COVID. So, you know, we will be in a new place, I think, by the fall. It'll feel much more like normal. And we may well be, you know, commonly wearing masks.
Atul Gawande is a staff writer and a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He'll join me again soon as we follow the course of the recovery from the COVID pandemic.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.